succession number 21564, reel 26.
Colonel Cormack, reel 26. You were describing Nienburg.
Yes, a delightful little town on the Weser. Because it was a smallish town, the military made a big impact, but we got on, generally speaking, very well. We had our regiment, we had an RCT regiment based close by with one squadron in our barracks, or next to our barracks. We had divisional troops, like a field support squadron, also in the town. We had a static Remy workshop in the area. We had a petroleum depot, an RAOC petroleum depot, in Nienburg. So there was quite a significant garrison there. We had two officers' messes, the regimental mess for and the sapper mess, and the other one for garrison troops. So we had the capacity for quite a decent social life in the garrison itself. Gradually, things we worked in more with the civilian population. There was very little trouble. Occasionally, one or two had a beer too many, and there was a fight in perhaps a nightclub that they shouldn't have gone to necessarily, but nothing out of bounds. But you had very little friction of that sort. And it improved. And then in the latter stages of my time in Nienburg, we had a big festival, a big fete, down on the Weserplatz, where our support squadron was stationed, big open space there. And that was the first of many for quite a few years when we had a football competition. Our squadrons played German local teams. There were sideshows, hot dog stands, all the things you associate with a fair, and a most enormous raffle of a car. And the local people came along and thoroughly enjoyed it. And our RSM, who was an adept at that sort of thing, as they often are, spoke good German and worked very hard with the local authority and the local mayor to get this going. And it worked. And I say relations were fairly good with the locals. We didn't get much of a chance to mingle with them socially, but we made one or two friends. They were perhaps civilians who were working with in the Remy workshop, the static units, for example. And there were many Germans employed in the barrack area and the garrison area all round. So there were contacts there, and they were developed. The other interesting thing in our time was that there was a German army unit just outside Nienburg, and we gradually got contact with them, and we started off in a small way, reception with a van d'honneur and a few speeches and a chance, and that was developing, and indeed did develop in the years afterwards. Mm-hmm. And to a regular flow of contact there. So we had the option of getting to know the German army, the new one, and meet civilians. We had a very flourishing tennis club there, and civilians were welcome. Not many came, but they were welcome, and one or two friendships were built up that way. I would say it was a happy little station.
What sort of German army unit was it?
It was a German brigade, an ordinary infantry brigade. It wasn't a tank unit. There wasn't the scope for that there. But it was just part of their new army.
What impression did you get of them militarily?
Very keen to do well, and very keen to impress on us how professional they were and how modern they were in their attitude and thinking. And I think they certainly had a considerable respect for the professional attitude and approach and performance of the BOR, the British Army, there. And that they had that built up over quite a number of years before they were forming their own West German Army, as it was then. And so they were looking at us as almost the old hands while they were learning, and I think they were learning very quickly.
Was there any scope for joint training or playing games together on exercises, that kind of thing?
Yes, we started days when they would come, a selected number would come to us, and we would lay on all our equipments and weapons, and they would practice those, and there was an engineer unit particularly would come down and see our equipment, have a chance to have hands-on experience. There we'd go to our local range and they would fire our weapons, and then they would reciprocate with a day when we would send teams across and do the same thing with theirs. It was a slow business, but that was a start in those days. And I think, again, it developed and became much more regular.
Around about that time, we were joining the European community, and there was discussion about development of a new European entity, which might or might not have implications for defence and security and so on. Were you aware of that at the time?
We were much more aware of NATO and what NATO was stood for and what it was intended to achieve, and our part in supporting NATO. That was much more important to us than anything from the new Europe, as it were.
Yes.
That was not having much of an impact on us, except on the economic side. The idea was that it would be a free trade area, as it was then, and eventually much more easy movement across Europe, etc. That was how we looked at the thing then. We didn't visualize, if you like, the situation we're in now. At that time, it was thought, good idea, let's have a common market, let's all work together and be able to move freely from one part to the other, job-wise, money-wise, and goods-wise, if you like, economic and social. Those we thought about, yes, but our main concern was NATO. That was the thing that we were supporting and working with, and that was the ideal that would maintain peace after the war, and it still was that the case in 1970, '71, '72.
I think your next move was to headquarters NORTHAG, which must have been another sudden change in circumstances.
Yes, there was a step in between. I went back to Chatham.
Yes.
I just get myself quite right. No, I had gone back to Chatham to be based there, but I was actually working in the MOD. And I did about 6 months with OR7, that's the Operational Requirements Branch for the Royal Engineers. And I had, after I left Nuremberg, there was I wasn't sure what my next job was going to be.
So there was a sort of gap in
there. There was a gap. Mm. And actually, what we did was we had a caravan and we bombed around Europe for a couple of months. And then I was called back have this job, temporary job in OR7, with an old friend of mine from Korea, John Ellican, who was the Colonel GS then. And I was working on a project. They were heavily overloaded, and I was working on the combat engineer tractor. And I think I may have mentioned that before, but that was the first attempt to have a piece of armored engineer equipment with similar protection and the same mobility as our own armor and APCs, and up to speed with the current range and the potential future range, instead of lagging behind as we did with our armored engineers. This would be a piece of engineer equipment that would enable us to get around the battlefield safely and quickly and give our engineer support to the forward troops in the combat teams and battle groups more effectively than we ever could before. It was basically a small tank, if you like, that had all singing and all dancing. It had a very powerful winch. It could go backwards, reverse as fast as it could go forwards. It had a wonderful anchor based on the rocket-propelled Holdfast, the Vinicom anchor after a well-known sapper at Mexia Christchurch, as it was then, which you could then fire as you were crossing the river and haul yourself out if it got difficult. Lots of little things like that. And it had a towing hook. It was extremely useful. And it was a concept from scratch. So I spent 6 months or more, I forget now exactly, working on this with the Royal Ordnance Factory at Leeds and with Mexi at Christchurch, which became part of Bradley, I think, in the end, changing this concept, improving it if we could, and then working with the ROF at Leeds, who were actually building the prototypes. And then I had to work out the trials directive to the people who were putting the thing through its paces to see if it really did work. And that was an extremely interesting project, working with, say, John the Olicum, whom I knew before. And then, oddly enough, the chap we picked to do the trials, and we set up a whole troop, which we had to get out of the establishment, which was quite difficult. And they had to do the trials in England, and then they took the tractors to BOR and used them there and demonstrated and showed the possibilities. The chap who ran that trial later worked for me in another capacity later on. He was a qualified technical staff officer who'd done a tank technology course and was well aware of the potential of armoured and tracks and the problems thereof.
What was the primary role of the tractor going to be?
It was to take, it had a two-man crew, radio, and it was proof against the effects of nuclear radiation and chemical warfare. But it was basically to get the engineers up into the battlefield area at the same time as the armoured and APCs. And I say, give us that same protection. And it, instead of having our cumbersome APCs, which were usually a generation or a half a generation behind the others, we were up to speed for the first time. And it proved to be a very successful piece of equipment.
What's it actually going to do? Because tractor implies something that tows something else, doesn't it, normally?
Well, it had a towing capacity, but that was incidental.
It wasn't the primary role of it.
No. Mm. It was to get us around and enable us to do things. Mm. It could tow the mechanical, the mine-laying equipment and things like that. Undercover, more effectively. And it was fast and mobile and amphibious. So it had all those benefits. Thank you, dear.
Who had the original idea for this vehicle?
Well, I'm not entirely certain. The various armies were working on this sort of equipment. The Americans had a thing called the Universal Engineer Vehicle, and we had were trying things. There were one or two ideas around, but none of them actually matched ours for compactness of size and its mobility and its amphibious capability.
How many men could you carry in it?
The crew were two plus one, yes.
Yes.
And that was all. But that was it could do so much from inside the equipment. That was the great joy of it. And I've no doubt in the years to come that would be modified and improved, or Mark II versions would come along. But it was very well received and proved exceptionally popular and gave the sappers quite a morale boost. I think they now had a piece of equipment that matched the others in the battle group and combat teams that we were supporting.
What stage was it at when you joined that project? Had they actually built anything, or were they still at the stage of producing ideas and
It was in the mock-up stage.
So mock-up.
And then it advanced from that. As people suggested, we had that added on. And there was an awful lot of people saying, let's button on this and button on that and add that, it will improve it. And one had to be very careful to prune those ideas down and discard those that were merely good ideas but would possibly handicap the tractor in its main role. And a lot of that discussion went on. People who thought it might climb trees or fly. We always get people like that. Keep our feet firmly on the ground. And then we saw it through to from the mock-ups into the first prototypes, which were built at Leeds. And we had two or three of those. And then they were looked at and inspected, and the trials team took them over. And then they improved the prototypes to the point when they were nearly production models that could be taken out and given a fair trial. It was a very interesting sidelight.
How did you get on with the people at the Royal Ordnance Factory?
Very well. They were all desperately keen to make this a success because it was for them, it was something entirely new. They were quite used to tanks, and they were quite used to the concept of designing tanks and building tanks and improved and modifying things, and they were quite used to guns and the design of those, the installation of those, and making sure they could be aimed and fired in the maximum sort of way. But it wasn't so different from going from a centurion to a chieftain. The principles were all, I wouldn't say it was dull, but it was something, the tractor was outside that run of things. It was something entirely new, which they were at the beginning building from scratch, if it were.
What was the tractor armed?
No, it didn't. People said, should it be armed? No, that would spoil things. Then you would have to have a gunner or someone dedicated to firing. So it wasn't armed in that extent, no. It just happened to be an extremely useful all-round bit of engineer equipment that could do a lot of things. The more it was used, the more these ideas, the more use was found for it, if you like.
You mentioned that it could project a hold fast and tow itself out of a...
If it was difficult, yes. It could actually drive out.
Yes. What were its other capabilities?
Towing mainly, and of course it could carry things.
Yes.
It had quite a carrying capacity, which could be ditched if necessary, of explosives and other equipments, and various power tools. It had power tool takeoffs that you could plug in, and a whole range of engineered power tools were developed, which would be run from that machine, and you just plug them in. Digging tools, particularly, were very useful. Drilling tools, saws. All the stuff that part and parcel of an engineer's life were there and could be used instantly. There was only one controversial thing about those power tools, is they were all 110 volt and not 220, which is something I didn't agree with. I wanted 220, but then you could, if necessary, you could plug them into any civilian source in Europe. But I think some people had an American market in mind. But that was only an impression I had. But that was it. It was just one per section. It was ideal.
And it could keep up with the latest mark of tank or
yes,
APC?
Easily. And it had a similar degree of protection. Mm. And it certainly was the equivalent of all the reconnaissance scout cars and APCs, the light tracked vehicles that were then coming in, I think the Fox range, those that came after. Yes, it was equally as good as those.
You mentioned going to trials. Where would those trials have been conducted and by whom?
Well, my trials team that we set up would take the trials through, and then they were responsible for producing the trials report, which would then evaluated by OR7, MEXI, and then any final changes before the main production run went into action. And that was done in the UK at MEXI again, where all the facilities for testing amphibious vehicles, and they had their own old airport near Christchurch, where they had scope to drive across country and face natural obstacles and all the standard obstacles that tanks had to go through before they were allowed out into the wide world, if you like. And then it would go to Germany to be demonstrated at Sendelager, Hohner, and other training areas where troops could see them and get the idea and give their own views on it. It was the usual process, but a slightly more elaborate one, as it was a brand new piece of kit.
Were you aware of any other projects going on of interest in OR7 at the time when you were there?
I was generally aware of things, but I was kept pretty busy on that. But each desk had its own responsibility, if you like. There was work on new bridging. The bridging for the 90s was the thing that the bridging desk were doing. And I just took a peripheral interest in that. Again, that was an improvement on the medium girder bridge. It was an entirely vehicle-mounted bridging system that they were working on, which came to pass some years later, but that was happening. A lot of work was being done for Northern Ireland at that time, and OR7 had an ordnance corps officer attached who was an explosive expert, and a lot of equipment was being designed for use in Northern Ireland to deal with improvised explosive devices. Various crowd control barriers were being looked at and tested. There was a massive range of new equipment for Northern Ireland underway, and money was being made available for that. I was aware in general terms of what they were. Detection equipment was very much the fore, and we were looking at improving our mine detecting equipment as at the same time. The detectors we used at that time were really very much just a one step forward from those used in the last war.
Like the standard metal detector.
That's right. And new ideas were coming in, and a combination of those that had already been developed by bomb disposal people, then now explosive ordnance disposal, to aid in the search for areas that we thought might be booby-trapped or ambushed. And a lot of work was going on in that, combining the slightly very effective but very heavy EOD equipment and marrying that with the lighter weight equipment that we would require. There's all sorts of things going on like that, of which I was just generally aware, as you would in working in an office like that. But I was pretty busy in my own thing, except that I had a second project, and that was it was my own idea, what I call reverse engineering. And if you have the Soviet Army engineers, in which I had already an interest, I spent some time looking at their equipment in more detail with the latest TechInt reports. And then I also went back to some very interesting documents that I got from the Bovington. They were some of the funnies used in the last war, or tried.
79th Armored Division.
That had not worked.
Such as?
Well, there was one that never would work, but we did look at the great Panjandrum.
What was that supposed to do?
That was an enormous wheel. It really was two huge wheels linked together, and it had the capacity to wrap around it a lot of explosive hose. And you've possibly on Guy Fawkes Night, you fired a Catherine wheel, and it goes spinning round and round as the rockets propel it round in a circle. And someone had the idea of getting this giant two wheels together with the hose in the middle and lots of rockets that you set off as you would a Catherine wheel. The thing would then roll forward, lay out the explosive hose through the minefield, and then blow a gap. Well, that was one that didn't work, and it was too unstable and never would. But there were other ideas. There were mine plows of various kinds that had been looked at and had failed, partly because the material was too heavy for what it was required, and the hydraulic systems were not effective enough, and they tended to bury themselves in the ground, and they had by and large been abandoned. There were flail tanks that had been used in the last war. They had been dropped, and they were been left and had not been part of the armored engineers' breaching equipment to any great extent. we looked at that and said, why did they fail? And in many cases, modern materials, such as the change from the heavy girder bridge to the medium girder bridge, would enable people to build these things and make them more effective. So we did a certain amount of work on that, mainly on the mine plough, because the Soviet engineers had used mine ploughs. And they had operated in a certain way, and we were just looking at that, and I just produced a paper of Soviet equipment that was worth bringing into our army, because there is no copyright on enemy equipment or potential enemy equipment. You don't have to worry about patents or anything else. Put the two together and see what you get. And out of that came some other people took it on, and we developed our own mine ploughs. The flail tank was modernized and became the aardvark with different materials, more effective and much quicker. That became part and parcel of the armored engineers and the armor, and I understand was used in the Gulf War. And those sort of things. So it was a little bit of reverse engineering and copying what the Soviets did. And I claim no credit for the fact that the Americans took on the Soviet Army PMP, that was their pontoon bridging, and we didn't have the money to develop it, but they made their own, essentially very similar to the Soviet one, and that became part and parcel of their bridging armory, if you like.
You mentioned the aardvark as a development from the flail tank. I think the principle difficulty with the flail tank was that while it was flailing, it could only go at about half a mile an hour.
Yes.
And it tended to kick up a lot of dust or mud, which made it conspicuous, and it made it an easy and easily identifiable target.
Yes, it was slow and cumbersome. Mm. It was very effective, of course. It did batter all the mines to bits, and
of course,
even those with secondary means of initiation, they were either blown up or they could be destroyed. The aardvark had the same problems. It was much faster, of course. It covered the ground more quickly, and its flails were not so liable to damage as the other units were, although by the very nature of things, it would require replacement parts. But I think you would use the flail tanks in situations when you could get away with making a hell of a noise or making a lot of cloud, or you could cover the operations by the use of smoke.
Well,
and other battlefield things like that. That was a matter of tactics,
yes,
which was apart from the development of the equipment as such, which I was more interested in at the time.
Well, flail tanks normally had to operate in pairs in a sort of echelon
to cover
in order to produce a wide enough lane.
Safe lane through, yes.
And, so normally they would have five in a troop, so while two were flailing, the other three would be projecting smoke and actually providing firepower as protection.
Yes, I mean, those things were all perfectly feasible. It would just depend on the urgency of the situation. In many cases, urgency was the overriding thing, and then you would simply batter through and clear your path.
What was the aardvark based upon? Because the flail tank was based upon a standard tank chassis.
That was a standard Sherman or Grant tank during the war, and I think it was modified. It may have been modified for the Churchill. I don't think it ever went on to the Centurion tank, if I recall correctly. I don't know what the prime mover of the aardvark was, but I would suspect it was a tractor very much the same as the Combat Engineer tractor.
Ah.
It was something like that, but it was developed by a commercial organization, again, as a venture, based on these ideas that we had prepared.
Now, there are a lot of other vehicles which were quite successful, which don't seem to have been carried on into peacetime, amongst them the petard tank.
Well, the petard was the spigot mortar,
yes,
which was the first